On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Remedy Selection for Contaminated Sediments. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's call. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC team. Today's training is based on the online guidance document, Remedy Selection for Contaminated Sediments. We're going to introduce you to this document during today's training class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. Our training today is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started. We are scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording the training today. The trainers control your slides, but if you want to be able to control your own slides, look back at the presentation, look forward, you can download the presentation, and that's back on that CLUIN training page where you started today. We do look for your questions and feedback. Throughout today's training, anyone is welcome to send in a question using that Q&A pod in the lower right. In some cases, we'll get right back to you with an answer. For other questions, we're going to ask those out loud at our question and answer breaks. We're going to have one in the middle and another at the end of today's presentation. We do ask that everyone fill out the feedback form at the end of today's training class. And that is available as a link on our last slide, but you can find that link at any time in the middle right in our related URLs. So look down, there's a feedback in those related URLs. Select Browse to open that feedback form in the new window. From the feedback form, you can create a certificate of participation for today's training. And right now, the only way to create that certificate is through the feedback form. So after attending the class, please be sure to fill out the feedback form, check the box to certify that you attended, and once you submit, the system's going to generate a certificate for you. More information about ITRC is available on the website. The ITRC Contaminated Sediments team was made up of local and state regulators, as well as members from industry, the federal government, and academia, as well as our stakeholders. The full version of the ITRC disclaimer is in the notes version of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We do ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of documents available. We have our training schedule for the rest of the year available. There's more opportunities to become more involved in ITRC. We have existing, and there's a couple of new teams starting in 2018. So please visit the ITRC website to learn more. I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All of our trainers were members of the ITRC Contaminated Sediments Remediation Team. That team was led by John Cargill from the state of Delaware and Greg Newman from New Jersey. Sarah Michael is an environmental scientist with the Department of Toxic Substances Control in Cypress, California. In her current remedial project manager position, Sarah is proficient in all aspects of corrective remedial action from discovery, investigation, negotiation and cost, remediation closure, to peer review and technical and administrative regulatory document development. She has recently been accepted into the California State University Fullerton Master's in Environmental Engineering program, where she returns for her second master's degree. Steve Clough is a senior environmental toxicologist at Haley and Aldrich in Manchester, New Hampshire. He has conducted numerous multi-pathway ecological risk assessments that require formulating conceptual site models, which are validated in the field by sampling of sediment and biota to determine the actual exposure and risk that environmental chemical stressors may pose to key receptors. Paul Duty is a principal engineer at Anchor QEA in Syracuse, New York. He is expert in multiple facets of contaminated sediments management, including remedial investigation, feasibility studies, treatability studies, remedial design, remedial construction oversight, and environmental monitoring. Dr. Tamara Sorrell is a National Risk Assessment Lead at Brown and Caldwell in Andover, Massachusetts. She has been responsible for the completion of evaluation at numerous sediment sites and has applied a variety of assessment tools, including food chain modeling, in-situ pore water measurement, hybrid carbon fingerprinting, and equilibrium partitioning. Rick Beach is the National Sediment Practice Leader at GZA in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. His recent projects focus on evaluating upland source of contamination, assessing potential contribution to water bodies, and developing scientifically based advocacy positions used for allocation of related liabilities. I'm now going to turn the presentation over to Sarah Michael at the Department of Toxic Substances Control. Sarah?
Thank you, Julianne. I appreciate that. On behalf of the ITRC Contaminated Sediments Remediation Team, I want to welcome everyone to this internet-based training event. I'll be your host for this introductory portion of today and passing the speaker baton over as we progress, and I'll be coming back later on as one of the closures for stakeholder concerns. In order to break the ice and get things rolling in a participatory manner, let's begin by asking a quick polling question, shown here to determine the contaminated sediments remediation experience level of our audience. This polling question is a quick way for today's presenters to determine the relative experience level of our audience from the starting gate. It provides important information for you too. While we wait for a moment or two for your responses to be gathered, I'd like to just quickly say that the Contaminated Sediments team has developed what we believe to be an exciting training event, inclusive of information and worksheets to assist you in escalating your efficiency and effectiveness in managing contaminated sediment remediation projects. From the results of our poll, we see the kind of variation that we kind of like to see in these training events. There are some people with quite a bit of knowledge. There are some people who are perhaps new to contaminated sediment remediation. That provides an environment from which we hope greater knowledge will be cultivated in today's training. Now, as we go along today, this poll will also provide each and every one of you the tool to self-evaluate your knowledge level of contaminated sediment remediation from the beginning and at the end of today's training event. We encourage you to reflect over this very same question. Our ITRC team is confident that during this training and thereafter, each of you will be empowered, that you will gain a more sophisticated understanding of managing contaminated sediment remediation projects, and therefore acquire more confidence with which you can participate in the decision-making arena. So it's important for us to focus on the numbers in this photograph. It's little fish advisories exist in nearly every state across the nation and elsewhere. And governed by our audience, an international audience, I might add, this and other ITRC trainings are attracting. Fish advisories are of international concern. In a majority of these cases, fish advisories exist because of the presence of contaminants in fish tissues. Contaminants such as mercury, PCBs, dioxins, chlorinated pesticides, and more. Moving up the food chain is alarming. It should come at no surprise when we say contaminated sediments act as a source of contamination to overlying surface water and to the biota that live in the superficial sediments that are eaten by higher trophic level species. A key word of association here is bioaccumulation, a process infinitely connected to bioavailability. Link to the previous contaminated sediments team document is shown here. That document introduces the concept of bioavailability. It contains a wealth of information about how to assess bioavailability when evaluating contaminated exposure pathways at contaminated sediment sites. Since some remedial approaches, such as capping and many in situ technologies, and remedial technologies aim at reducing risk by addressing the bioavailability of site contaminants, it's another source that our team believes will be beneficial to you. To add further benefit to this training, some of today's instructors were members of the bioavailability team. We've gathered them along with a host of other experts and professionals from across the nation to harvest their knowledge and their firsthand experiences to develop and provide this incredible training event on our efforts to evolve remediation technology and techniques provided in our guidance document and to provide a tool for you and others to advance remediation decision processes for contaminated sediment projects. Some may ask, why develop an ITRC guidance document about sediment remediation? Well, we could easily and very quickly look back for just a moment to the poll we took at the beginning. For those who indicated a lack of experience with remediation of contaminated sediment sites, that simply demonstrates the need. Without the poll question, though, our team believes a well-thought and reasoned response is essential for you. Sediment sites are unique and often very complex. The potential for multiple sources, contaminants, habitats, waterway use, potentially challenging, which may drive up the expense to remediate. Evaluation and selecting the optimal remedy can become complicated. Remedy selection framework and comparison are absent from current sediment guidance documents. While current guidance documents provide an abundance of good and useful information about technologies, they do not provide a comprehensive remedy selection framework, a progressive comparison process. So let's move forward. We want to advance existing technologies and present the capabilities of new, potentially innovative technologies. This often requires a multidisciplinary approach. Our ITRC contaminated sediment remediation team, we genuinely believe that we are providing a valuable, essential information, data, and solutions to these and other obstacles. We encourage you to read, review, and reference the guidance document for which this training was developed. So why use the guidance document, you may ask? Well, our team gathered experts, like I said, from around the country. We harvested knowledge and documented information from the academic arena, seasoned environmental consultants, state and federal regulators, and community stakeholders to develop the guidance document and training material, and with ITRC at the helm, a free training event for you. This guidance document provides each of you with tools to assist in determining the appropriate data necessary to evaluate and select remedy and advancements in the old and new sediment remediation technology, MNR, EMNR, in situ, capping, dredging, removal, to mention a few. We have a platform for the latest information. This online guidance document was built with a point-click-go feature. The decision framework and downloadable worksheets for site-specific evaluation and data retention. Technology assessment guidelines, including guidance on how to most effectively use them. The tools necessary to address the applicability of remedial technologies to your site. The right questions to ask yourself when evaluating alternatives and selecting remedies. We have over 80 case studies. As a team, you know it was impossible for us to address variability among local, state, and federal regulations. We have to leave that up to you, the user, to determine whether or not there are state, local, regional specificities that must be taken into consideration when evaluating technologies. What we have done in preparation is developed a six-step remedy evaluation framework to assist you. I'm sorry, just a moment here. This six-step framework for evaluating all sediment remediation technologies is based on site-specific data. The framework diagram provides navigation through the web-based guidance. This diagram is used throughout this lecture series to allow you to understand your position in the framework. The framework contains important site-specific characteristic review, zone mapping and development, initial screening, detailed technology evaluation with data needs and technology assessment guidelines to develop and evaluate alternatives. Keep in mind, our electronic guidance document has the point, click, and go capability to take you wherever you want to go throughout the document, to the section of importance to you at your fingertips. Other advantages of this guidance document is it's user-friendly, online comprehensive resource. This drives the user to information throughout the framework process. Technology overviews, up-to-date information driven by site specific data and inclusion of technology assessment guidelines. You will see these tags throughout this training. This is where and how our team experts, remember all those folks I mentioned earlier, their experiences are noted, describe the linkage from tables to text and explanations. An advantage of your participation today is the capability to ask questions of them as we move through the training. We will follow two remedy selection framework, an advanced decision framework that enhances your ability to participate in the remedy selection process. Worksheets that allow the user to document decision points throughout the remedy selection process. Site-specific data-driven technology selection. Wow. This provides information to help develop and evaluate remedial alternatives based on site-specific characteristics, including combination remedies, multiple technologies used at a single site. Advanced remedy evaluation goes beyond the NCP criteria. More advantages of today's training is this particular training event stands out because we're providing each of you with a complete and thorough overview of the content and functionality of the ITRC Contaminated Sediments Remediation Team online guidance document. We will provide you with examples on how to most effectively use the decision framework and the opportunity again to ask questions from our national experts. Please note, with your active participation, and of course your feedback at the end, you can help make this and future offerings of this training even better. We hope this training event will provide you with knowledge, innovative tools, those necessary to better identify site-specific characteristics, data, and information needs. We hope you will gain the ability to better evaluate favorable technologies and to identify unfavorable technologies. And most important, we hope to provide you with the incentive, no, the confidence to apply what you have learned. You are going to be the experts. In order to do that, we had to develop some assumptions for successful use of this guidance document. The nature and extent of contaminants of concerns originating from on-site sources and other on-site characteristics have been characterized sufficiently in conjunction with a conceptual site model to support remedy selection. Another is human health and ecological risk assessments have been completed for the site and have determined that the site poses an unacceptable risk. Other environmental endpoints that are to be protected have been identified. Contaminant loading by releases from site-related sources have been controlled, or the ongoing contribution of the site releases to site sediment contamination has been determined. Remedial action objectives have been established in concert with stakeholder input. Three of today's presenters will build upon this example during the presentation to illustrate guidance features and the usefulness of the guidance document functionality. How to use the contaminated sediment remedy selection framework. How to apply these processes to your site. Identify and establish zones. An overview of data important when assessing remedial technologies. How to access current information about sediment remediation technologies to gain a deeper understanding of how site-specific characteristics drive selection of remedial technologies. Remember, the more you use this framework, the more advanced your skills will become, like riding a bicycle. It's now, let's move forward, and I'd like to keep this going by introducing one of our leading experts, Steve Clough, environmental toxicologist with Haley and Aldrich.
And Steve,
Yep,
there you go.
I think I just unmuted. Yeah, okay. Sorry. I guess it helps to unmute. Thank you, everybody. Okay, so I will be presenting the first three steps in the Remedy Selection and Evaluation Framework document. That's a review of site characteristics, remedial zone identification and mapping, and screening of remedial technologies. So in slide 18, the first step is to review your site characteristics, and I'd like to start off with a personal note here. I've just finished working at the Hastings-on-Hudson site on the Hudson River, and we developed a baseline sampling and analysis plan there. And my experience was with investigating surface water, sediment, pore water, fish, and habitat. So I've run the gamut of reviewing site characteristics and want to try to convey some of this information to you today. So 9 out of 10 times an RI will require additional data. That may be a supplemental RI or pre-design investigation to support the conceptual site model. And the team members divided the document into four different genres as far as site characterization, and that is the physical, sediment, contaminant, and land and waterway use. So on the physical side, we may have one of the most common problems is debris fields, and then identifying your bathymetry, your underwater topo map, hydrodynamics, things like that. On the sediment side, you may have scour zones, you may have depositional zones. You've got to identify how stable the sediment bed is and your benthic community. On the contaminant side, I think everyone's familiar with how to investigate nature and extent, certainly on the upland. And on the sediment side, remember that sediments know no boundaries, so you're going to have upstream and downstream influences, certainly from the downstream. If you're like in an estuary, you have tidal effects. But contaminants, you want to know your horizontal nature and extent, but also your vertical. And you might want to also be looking at forensics, PCBs, pH, as forensics comes into play there. And then finally, land and waterway use. Like at the Hastings site, we had a lot of barges regularly going by, which had intervals of some significant wave energy, so you need to consider that in your remedial design. But the basic rule of thumb when reviewing site characteristics is every time you check a box or dip your toe in the water, you're going to have questions or surprises that you did not anticipate. And so it's really key to keep your eye on the initial conceptual site model and the initial questions that you ask. Don't go down any rabbit holes, at least not too deeply. So on the physical genre, infrastructure is critical. This photograph in the upper right here is at the Hastings site, and we had a lot of old infrastructure that was demolished and some fairly deep pilings. And one reason I mention this is because in my experience, at the sediment sites that have failed when it comes to cleanup and capping and remediation, everything gets done and they go out and resample, and lo and behold, they have recontamination. And this is usually due to fugitive migration of contaminants from between pilings and underneath piers. So you need to be very aware of your infrastructure. Bathymetry is is really where you should start out. You shouldn't have a bathymetry map that is any older than 5 years, certainly not 10 years. You want a bathymetry map that is as recent as you can get it. And this will identify debris fields, certainly dams and large areas. It does a very good job of documenting things in the littoral zone. This is your topo map. It will form your base map for all of your future investigations and is a critical piece of information. On the hydrodynamics side, at the Hastings site, we had tides moving in both directions. You had a lot of scour. If you're in a freshwater river, you might have channel sinuosity, which has hydrodynamic effects. So that's very important. And remember that bathymetry affects hydrodynamics. Slope stability, this is strongly affected, again, by hydrodynamics and the type of sediment in the littoral zone. So in the littoral zone, dredging will affect this zone, certainly, and will also undermine any bulkheads if you have bulkheads on the shoreline. Groundwater-surface water interaction, this is critical. You do not want any contaminated groundwater moving into the sediment OU. So You want to make sure that all of your upland, this lower picture here, all of your upland sources are controlled and that contaminated groundwater is not moving into the sites, because you don't want to do remediation and then have all that nice clean fill or cap or whatever recontaminated. And finally, on the physical side, habitat is critical. Habitat drives just about everything in terms of ecological risk. For example, at the Hastings site, we had submerged aquatic vegetation. This is a sacred cow in most states. They do not want to dig up aquatic vegetation. They want to save it at all costs. So if it does have to be remediated, it will have to be replanted. So moving on to slide number 20 under the realm of sediment, what's important to define is your geotechnical side of the equation. What is the grain size distribution? Will you have coarse sand in areas? Probably not. Most sediment sites are depositional areas, so you might likely have silt or clays or some combination thereof. What is the potential for resuspension? I'm not an engineer, but they have what's called sed flume testing. You'll go out and you'll take sediment cores or bring it back to a lab and expose that core under different hydrodynamic conditions under a sed flume and figure out what will be the stability of the sediment bed in terms of remediation or even MNR. Sediment consolidation, it's important for a cap design. So if you're going to bring in a cap, will the underlying sediment support this cap? And finally, the benthic community structure. At Hastings, we used a combination of sediment profile imaging and collected grabs for benthic macroinvertebrates. So this photo over on the right, this is you use like a prism-like device that goes down into the sediment. It's about an 18-inch centimeter photo, and it will define your anoxic zone, your oxidized zone, and your benthic community, and it will give you details like feeding voids, methane bubbles, things like that. And we use this information. It was very, very good for the layperson to understand if you're giving a presentation about what's going on in the sediment bed. And we combined this with sampling of benthic invertebrates, and we calculated a functional matrix using abundance and diversity. And we also looked at pollution-sensitive and pollution-tolerant organisms. So this is very helpful in identifying what's going on within the sediment realm. Slide 21, contaminant, distribution of contaminants. From my point of view, what's critical is background. You need to have a frame of reference against which you can judge what's at your site. So in Massachusetts, we call it local conditions. You want to have, say, upstream, adjacent, and downstream samples, and you want to have some ratio of your background samples to adjacent or downstream. So I kind of like to have a minimum of two background samples. And for, let's say you have four adjacent to the site and two upstream. If you add more adjacent, you want to add more reference samples so you have a good statistical comparison to make. I mean, ideally, you'd have the same number of upstream as your site, but a lot of budgets can't handle that. So this is critical in defining upstream influences, which includes stormwater culverts, non-point runoff, CSOs, combined sewer overflows, agricultural runoff. So what's going on upstream and what's going on within the watershed? What are your contaminant types? At most sediment sites, you're going to have what's called PBT contaminants, persistent bioavailable and toxic. So you kind of have to look at, do you have PCBs, pHs at MGP sites? Some of the newer sites may have PFAS contamination if it's near, say, a fire training or an airport, something like that. Ebullition is important at MGP sites. Do you have blebbing up through the sediment, methane gas generation? That will mobilize NAPL. Distribution, again, I mentioned you not only horizontal distribution, but vertical distribution. And typically, you need the 0 to 6-inch sample for ECO. And then as you go lower into the 6-inch to 1 foot and then 1 foot and below, that more that more defines not your biotic zone, but your engineering type of issues, such as how much do you have to clean up. And then bioavailability, exposure, bioaccumulation, and biomagnification. Sarah mentioned that there's a document incorporation of bioavailability considerations into the evaluation of contaminated sediment sites. And I'd strongly urge anyone on this call to review that ITRC document because it is chock full of information. Slide number 22, land and waterway uses. What is the current and anticipated use of the site? So on the land side, what is the future use of the upland? Is it going to be commercial? Is it going to be industrial? Are you going to have residential condos, that type of thing? Well, maybe there might be a boardwalk. And then on the waterway side, are you going to have things like a marina? Is there going to be regular boat traffic, that type of thing? Site access is important. For example, at the Hastings site, we figured how will regular passage of cars and trucks affect the community during the remedial investigation or the remedial process. Watershed characteristics, are your flood zones defined? Have you gotten hold of all the FEMA maps? Certainly with what's happened in Houston and in Florida, I guess some of the old flood zones may not even be relevant anymore. Have you discussed CSOs and stormwater? At Hastings site, we had ice flows during the winter. So all of these need to be considered as far as what's going on in the watershed. Sensitive habitat and species, again, just about every state, if you have a wetland, it's going to be a sensitive area. But have you documented threatened, sensitive, or endangered species? And again, if you have like a wetland, a vegetated wetland, you don't want to dig that up just because it's contaminated. You may want to have some give and take with a regulatory agency about just whether, you know, if it contains PCBs, well, if it's below one part per million, maybe you don't want to dig that wetland up. And then cultural and archaeological resources. This genre is rarely addressed, but I think it should be considered in the due diligence step. So step two is remedial zone identification and mapping. Divide and conquer. It's a lot easier if you divide your site into different zones based on their physical and chemical characteristics. So this is usually based on nature and extent, but you're going to have other variables that come into play. And an example here might be identifying zones based on lower or higher energy deposition. So you have a meandering river, and on the concave side, you're going to have erosion, and on the convex side, you're going to have deposition. So these type of things need to be taken into account when you're looking at your remedial zones. This is just one example of one variable that needs to be taken into account. The approach for zone identification usually starts with identification of the contaminant types and the distribution. But you will also have to evaluate other distinguishing characteristics, such as maybe the results of toxicity tests, the congener forensics in sediment or fish. Another example might be the high rate of sediment deposition in different areas, and maybe something as esoteric as pore water and bioavailability. So you may have high bulk concentrations in sediment, but you may have very low concentrations in pore water, and that's what the benthic invertebrates are going to be exposed to. So the number of zones you pick will always be site-specific and can range from highly complex to very simple, depending on your lines of evidence. So this is an example of a site that we worked on in San Francisco Bay. It's an MGP site. It was a very simple grid starting out because it had uniform bathymetry. So we just had three columns initially to start. We had on the side furthest from the shoreline, we had the green column, which is ambient. And then we had on the left-hand side of the figure, we had the most contaminated column, which would be the littoral zone next to the MGP site. And then in between, we had kind of a gradient. And then we divided those three columns into nine different segments just for workability and sampling. And so we used a multiple lines of evidence approach. We looked at the bentha community. We did toxicity tests. We looked at caged mussels, polychaetes in the sediment itself, and we looked at pore water. And we gauged each one of these using pentagonal icons, trying to give the reader some degree of confidence as to what was going on in terms of was it lightly contaminated or was it heavily contaminated. Getting to our hypothetical example site, the first step would be to do benchmark screening. So this is PCBs, lead, and chlordane in different sediment samples. And we used they binned them according to, is it, for example, close to a TEC or an ERL, or is it maybe, which would be green, or is it above a PEC or an ERM, which would be red, or would it be between the two, so which would be yellow. And you can see there's some type of a correlation between all three co-contaminants. And so this helps you identify different zones and put priorities on what your triage process is in terms of what your remedy might be. So in slides 27, we continue with this example, only we're going to look at zone 3 down at the bottom here. So up at the top, we have an area that is bulkheaded. And in the middle, we have soft sediment, but we have an area that is conducive to habitat, so there might be some eelgrass we need to be considerate of. And down below, we have a debris field and sediment deposition. So these are things you have to look at when you're considering your zones and the decisions you're going to make. So getting onto decisions, that's a good segue into step 3. How are we going to decide what our remedy is going to be and maybe how we're going to divide our zones up? So in section 2.6 of the document, table 2.3 provides a spreadsheet that contains questions pertaining to each remedial technology. So it goes through MNR, maybe thin layer capping, enhanced MNR, dredging, capping, that type of thing. So you as the user will fill in the cells with specific data to help you evaluate each remedial technology and determine their applicability. So the exercise will definitely help you eliminate one or more technologies from further consideration. So this is an example of table 2.3, and in this case we have it starts off, the document goes through the least invasive to the most invasive, so it would be the least expensive to the most expensive. So we start off with MNR, and for example, in the third column down, we have net sediment deposition rates are adequate to consider natural sedimentation as a reasonable alternative to meet RAOs, the third row down. So the user will click yes. And how confident are we in this? Well, we're medium confidence, and we'll put in a note that says the site is classified as depositional on state maps, but the rate of deposition is not yet known. So you will go down through each one of these questions. You'll determine if the condition is present or absent, and you'll give your vote of confidence. This is a qualitative exercise, pretty much. And another example would be on slide 30 for enhanced MNR. So, for example, in the third row down, we'll say characteristics of the site do not inhibit or prevent placement of enhancement materials. The user clicked yes, confidence in medium is medium, and the note says applicable to zone 3, medium score low because it's located in an urban setting. So you go through each one of these spreadsheets for the each remedial technology, and in the end, you'll come to so you'll go through in-situ treatment, conventional capping, amended capping, dry excavation, and wet excavation. In the end, you'll click a button to generate your remedial technology evaluation worksheet, which really acts as a great springboard to bring to your staff manager, whoever you're working with, to make a decision about, you know, is the whole site going to be MNR, or are we going to maybe do in-situ treatment, maybe enhanced MNR, that type of thing. So I have gone through the first three steps of this particular chapter in the document, and we're going to move on to Paul Duty, who's a very competent and experienced remedial engineer with Anchor QEA, who will show you more about the decisions you can make using this contaminated sediment remedy framework. Paul, take it away.
And Paul, pound six to unmute if you're able to.
Juliana, can you hear me?
We can. That's great. Thank you.
All right. Well, if the sound starts to be irritating, let me know. I can go straight to the phone. I'm actually down in Florida here and doing the best I can with technology. So hopefully this will work well. Thanks, Steve, for going through the first couple of steps here of our evaluation framework. I'm going to take you through step four of the framework here, which is really evaluating the different technologies. Steve kicked it off with kind of the initial screening, and I'll walk through the next step. But before we get into it, I wanted to start things off with a poll question. Give folks a chance to just click on which technologies you've utilized in your work. Give a sense to us for kind of the level of expertise in different technology use. So typically what we see is a fairly decent blend here, definitely with MNR, capping, excavation, and dredging, maybe not so much on the EMNR or amended caps, which is good, something to work from. All right, I think I advanced the slide here. So step four, what does it involve here is we want to go through a screening step to a subsequent more detailed evaluation of the different technologies and the four basic technologies are listed there, and I'll talk a little bit more about them. In the guidance document, we've got a detailed section on each of these technologies, and the real purpose of this step is to determine the most favorable technologies that then will go into a detailed evaluation of and assembled into alternatives. It'll go through a more detailed evaluation that tomorrow we'll talk about in a little bit here. One of the unique aspects to this guidance is we developed some technology assessment guidelines to help the users to evaluate the applicability of these different technologies. And I'll provide a little bit more detail on that and some of the navigation tools that we have in the guidance document for folks to use. As far as the guidance itself, we've got a section on each of the basic technologies, the monitor natural recovery in section 3, in situ treatment section 4, capping in 5, removal in section 6. And then within each of these sections, there's a description of the technology and a summarization of kind of recent developments. I'd encourage folks to recognize that recent developments was recent when the guidance was developed a year or two ago. So I'd encourage you to do a little bit of research to see maybe there's some more additional developments that have taken place. Each section has a pretty long discussion of technology assessment guidelines and also provides some case studies of each of the technologies to refer to. So I'll walk through each of the basic technologies mainly to give you some definition of how the guidance has set these up. But the first basic technology of monitored natural recovery, or MNR, some may refer to this in upland sites as monitored natural attenuation. It's a similar technology in that you're really relying on natural processes to improve conditions in the waterway. Enhanced MNR, by definition, is kind of an application of some technology to enhance those natural recovery processes. Steve had mentioned a thin layer cap. Maybe you place a thin layer of material to boost the deposition, or maybe addition of some amendments. You can see in that right-hand lower panel was the addition of some activated carbon on the surface of the sediment, and you can kind of see how the benthic organisms have pulled some of that activated carbon into the sediment matrix. So that's how we define the EMNR and MNR. In situ treatment, the definition here really is if you can apply some amendment to the sediments in an effort to facilitate treatment of the contaminants in the sediments. And It can use biological, chemical, or physical approaches or combinations of thereof. Some keys to success, of course, are picking the right amendment so that it actually accomplishes the treatment you desire. How are you going to deliver that amendment? And recognize limitations with the application and how you might actually apply the material. I would say of all of the technologies, it's probably one of the fastest evolving technologies. So again, the guidance is dated. So do a little research to see what the latest and greatest information is on these in situ technologies. I would say the more developed are the use of activated carbon to reduce bioavailability of some organic contaminants, and solidification stabilization, and addition of an agent to help immobilize contaminants. Both of those technologies are pretty well developed to a full scale. In fact, the Gowanus Canal rod specified solidification and stabilization for some of the deeper sediments at that site. Capping, by definition, really is placement of some clean material over the sediment in order to perhaps stabilize the sediment to reduce the potential for erosion and resuspension. To isolate that contaminated sediment can be another objective to limit the migration of contaminants from the sediment into the overlying water column and be available for exposure to the biology, the fish, and benthic organisms. It also physically separates the benthic community from the sediment. Some considerations that are discussed are, whether or not you need some armoring to protect the actual cap. Maybe isolation material may need some stone. You can see in the bottom panel, actually use of marine armor mattresses, which are stone-filled baskets that can be placed over the isolation layer to provide that armoring. Also use of amendments to add to the chemical isolation materials to enhance the absorption or even treatment of contaminants that may be migrating from the sediment up through the cap and into the water column. And finally, I'd say the other thing you need to look at is after you've designed a cap, do you need to consider or what considerations do habitat play in with what's left in the water column? Big, large stone may not be desirable in certain circumstances, and you may need to consider the addition of another layer of material to provide habitat, appropriate habitat for the organisms in that water body. Removal, which is really the most commonly deployed methodology for sediment cleanup, kind of break that down into dredging, where you can hydraulically dredge or mechanically dredge, which really is removal through the water column. You see the clamshell dredge on the photo there, pulling sediment up through the water column, kind of by definition is dredging. Excavation, on the other hand, is where the circumstances where you can isolate the contamination and be able to pull and dewater the area so that you can use more traditional excavation means to remove the sediment. Each of these have their advantages and disadvantages and need to be assessed at each site. And don't forget the other support aspects to dredging. It's not just removing the sediment. You need to do something with that sediment. You need to consider whether it needs to be dewatered, how you're going to transport it, how you're going to dispose of it. Also, are there opportunities to beneficially use the material in some other fashion? So all of this is all discussed in Section 6 of the guidance. And when you're dealing with removal, and in particular dredging technologies, what's referred to as the 4 R's, some of the inevitable aspects of dredging, resuspension of materials is inevitable. There are methods to help mitigate that, but you're not going to eliminate it. Residuals is the you're going to leave some material behind that may be fallback as part of the dredging process or missed inventory. For material that's resuspended, you may see release, or typically do see release of contaminants into the water column. And then, of course, the resulting risk associated with all of those processes. I mentioned earlier these technology assessment guidelines, which is a really unique aspect of this guidance document. When we were developing this guidance, we were looking for both quantitative and qualitative guidelines that we could apply relative to each of those characteristics that Steve introduced. And what we did is we provided that within each of the technology sections. So how, you know, some guidelines of, and I'll show you some examples here, but how can you assess the applicability or the favorability of that technology based on the different characteristics in some of these guidelines? We tried to base them on real simplified models, relationships, and in large part, I would say, the experience of the team that was developing the guidance. An important aspect, obviously, is to assemble the site-specific information you have for your particular site so that you've got something to compare to. One caution that we use and try to make clear in the guidance is it's really, these are intended to be used as practical guidelines and really used in a weight of evidence approach and not really as kind of singular pass-fail criteria. So the real idea here is to get an overall sense with a weight of evidence approach. All right, so I'm going to spend a little bit of time and give folks an idea of one of the navigation tools we have in the guidance document. It's table 2.4 in the technology evaluation section. And the way it's organized, I'll talk through the table first and then show you a couple of examples of the navigation. So for each of the characteristics, and here on this particular slide, we've just shown a handful of the physical characteristics that Steve had introduced. So you've got sediment stability and down the line. And then you have a column for each of the different technologies, remedial technologies. And then within each of the cells, you have information as an H, you'll see H, M, or L. And what that's intended to show is that, as an example, for M and R, that's an H means that sediment stability for MNR, that H would designate it's of high importance. M would be of moderate or medium importance, and low would be low importance. So we tried to assess what are those real important parameters for each of the technologies. If you see a little blue tag symbol, the little flag there, that means there's a assessment guideline for that particular element, and then the section number is shown here. So that's kind of what's in the table. From a navigation standpoint, if you want to look at sediment deposition rate as it relates to MNR, and you go to that cell, you'll again see it's an H, and you actually have a technology assessment guideline. If you click on that, that will take you to that section in the guidance. So really kind of a handy tool to be able to navigate around through each of the technologies and through all of the characteristics that Steve had mentioned. And then within each, you know, we've got a section written for sediment deposition rate, and this is in the MNR section, where we've got a narrative about that. And if you see blue font with that tag symbol, that provides the assessment guideline. And in this particular case, you can see a numeric value down at the bottom of the blue text, basically suggesting that sites with net deposition rates much greater than annual erosion or resuspension, and with annual net deposition rates greater than roughly 0.5 centimeters a year are prime candidates. So it doesn't mean it's not applicable if it doesn't meet that, but this provides some quantitative estimate of those types of sites that may be prime candidates. Then maybe it's another example of a more qualitative tag is if we use look at hydraulic dredging and the presence of hard bottom. And if we click on that, that takes us to section 6.6.6 in the removal section. And here you can see the blue font is kind of scattered throughout. So we tried to highlight those elements we thought were most important in assessing hydraulic dredging relative to the presence of hard bottom. And you can see here these are really more narrative, but should provide the user with some good guidance on how that technology may be applied with that particular characteristic. So if we take, and this next slide here is a busy chart. I'm not intending folks to be able to read this, but it does provide an overview of the next step in the evaluation, which is to take all that information from these from table 2-4 where we were navigating around. And the concept is that for each of the technologies and each of the physical characteristics, you will have reviewed how that may be important at your site. And then we've provided the spreadsheet, and actually what this is a carryover from the screening spreadsheet that Stephen introduced, where if you have screened out certain technologies, they wouldn't even show up here. And in fact, in the particular example that we've been using of Zone 3, at that example site, dry excavation was screened out, so it doesn't even show up on this particular spreadsheet. Now I'm going to talk a little bit more here, but the concept is to look at each of these physical characteristics, and then the second column is site-specific information. So for your site, and in this case for Zone 3 of your site, the idea is that you'll be starting with a blank spreadsheet is to fill in each of the cells for site-specific information. So for sediment stability, you would enter some text, and then you would assess how each of these technologies might be applicable at your particular site, a particular zone at your site. And so the idea really is to spend the time, be thorough, make sure that you look at this in detail. This is going to take quite a bit of time, when you're talking about a complex site with years of investigation, spending several weeks pulling this together is not out of line. So take your time on this, be thorough. The real purpose of this table is to be a tool. Think about 5 years from now if you want to go back to a decision that was made and you want to understand why you screened out a certain technology at some phase, this would provide some good documentation for you down the road. So I'll talk a little bit more here in the next couple of slides on how to build the spreadsheet and do the assessment. So these are just examples. So for sediment deposition rate under MNR for this particular zone, we felt that the net deposition rate was positive for MNR. And so you go through and you fill all of these out, of course, for each of the different technologies. When we look at hydraulic dredging and the presence of debris. In this particular zone, there was a lot of debris and felt that it could be a significant problem for hydraulic dredging and could increase resuspension. So this is that particular text is what we entered into the spreadsheet and something that you'd be able to go back to in the future. So after you've completed all of that, and for each of the four categories of the characteristics, and in this case is the physical characteristics. So for MNR and for each of the technologies, but I've got MNR and hydraulic dredging blown up here. You as a user would click on whether you felt MNR would be a favorable technology at that site, whether it would be moderately favorable or unfavorable. Well, if you click on favorable, the cell beneath it turns green, and the cell beneath it is a place for you to put notes as a kind of an overall summary looking at the weight of evidence for that particular technology. Similarly, on removal with hydraulic dredging, we felt that was unfavorable due to the significant debris that would require a separate operation. So click that unfavorable, it turns orange. If you use moderately favorable, it turns yellow. And then you do that for all four characteristic categories. And after you've done that and you've completed this spreadsheet, you hit and click on the generate report. And when you click on that, it generates a nice summary table for you. And what this is the notes that you had incorporated for each of the technologies, for each of the four technology group or four characteristic groups of physical characteristics, sediment characteristics, contamination, and land and waterway characteristics, provide you a nice summary, both color-coded and with your notes, that you can carry forward into the next step. step of the equation. And kind of the takeaway here is maybe more green and yellow is more favorable than obviously the orange and the yellow. So what I'm going to do at this point, I think, is open it up for questions and answers, and then tomorrow Thorl will take over after the Q&A here, and we'll take it from there. Juliana, I don't know if you want to administer the Q&A here.
I'll do that. Thanks, Paul. Everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right, so just feel free to type in a question, and throughout the second half, you're welcome to add in more questions. If you're on the phone line, it's #6 to unmute, and that you can ask those questions out loud. So we have a couple questions that have come in. Is MNR the same as MNA, monitored natural attenuation?
Yeah, I'll take that one, Juliana. Yeah, I think I had mentioned when I went through it, so I don't know, maybe that question came in before we got to it. But yes, I would call them synonymous, I guess, with what folks refer to as MNA. I think MNR is a little bit more commonly used in sediment sites than MNA, but it is essentially the same thing, where you're relying on natural processes to facilitate the remediation.
Another question, how do we get to that table 2-3 with that downloadable spreadsheet?
Good question. I believe it's available when you're in the guidance to download. Click on and download, but maybe somebody else has a better, more definitive answer to that.
Yeah, this is Steve Clow. I believe that slide, and I can go back to it, but I think it's in the same, it's on the slide. It says section, hold on for a second here. I think it's in section 2 of the document.
2.6.
Yeah, section 2.6. Should be in the web-based document.
It's also on the training outline. If you follow this link, interactive worksheet available, you can select that right now, and that's going to allow you to access that worksheet.
Yeah.
Would you require geofluvial survey and suspended sediment sampling to be done to feed into the evaluation of technologies?
Yeah, I don't think we try to say require. I think the theme would be to collect data that fits your site. There may be sites that are more complex where more thorough, detailed kind of assessment tools would make sense, and maybe other smaller, simpler sites where some of those investigation tools may not be needed. So it really is a judgment, site-specific judgment call. I don't know, Steve or others, if they've got additional input on that.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, I would think that's a site-specific judgment call. I'm not an engineer, but I would think that you would only need to do that if you're going to put a thin layer cap or a regular conventional cap. Would you agree with that, Paul?
Paul's kind of answering Rick Mike. Go ahead, Paul. Paul?
Oh, sorry, guys. Can you hear me?
We can, yes.
Yeah, I think it really depends on the different technologies, whether it's capping or whatever, Steve, on those two particular items. I mean, I think the geofluvial survey could be helpful in MNR assessment as well, depending on the site.
It really is
site specific.
This is Rick. I had a site recently. It's three tidal basins that were connected, and the suspended load was so high that it was really an issue that whether or not even the characterization wasn't changing tide cycle by tide cycle. So if you're trying to evaluate your alternatives, knowing what your continuing contaminant flux, even not from a one-sided but moving back and forth, could influence that would be critical. So depending on the site, it could be critical or it could be totally without merit.
A follow-up question on that downloadable spreadsheet. Page 41 in the guidance document has a link to Table 2-3, but we can't find the Table 2-5. Does that come after you fill out the 2-3 and evaluate?
Yes. Yeah, so as soon as you hit the generate report that Steve went through, after you've done the screening, then it generates the spreadsheet that I went through and as table 2.5. So kind of each step of the way generates a new spreadsheet for the subsequent step.
What is the minimum site size that is appropriate for this approach? Does not seem to be applicable to a 20-foot-wide Appalachian mountain stream.
Yeah, this is Steve Clow. I can feel that. I have worked on small brooks and streams in Massachusetts. One that I recall is contaminated with lead that was about 20 feet wide. So the key question is, well, if it's 20 feet wide, then how long? So I had to do different transects down the stream to figure out when I would approach the concentration that would seem like background or local conditions. So it may be 20 feet wide and it may be a small stream, but in the state of Massachusetts and probably New Jersey and other states, it doesn't matter. It's still a sensitive area, a sensitive critical pathway. So anytime you have a wetland and you have contamination in the wetland and you exceed the state sediment quality standards, if they have them, you still need to do some type of remediation. And if you don't do remediation, you have to give them a reason why, for example, it's not bioavailable to ecological receptors.
And the other thing I would say, Steve, to add to that is just as a general note, is I think this guidance can be applied to any of these sites. It's all up to the judgment of, you know, how you fit the evaluation, the collection of data to your proper, you know, site characteristics, site size being one of those. So it doesn't mean you have to
right.
do everything at every site. You know, you gotta use judgment.
Yeah, I think the document could just be useful just in site characterization alone. You don't have to go further into the document. I mean, just as long as you've got all your boxes checked, say, under site characterization, then the document's helpful.
Can you address how to handle situations where many options are precluded, such as dredging in a shipping channel?
Probably depends on how or why they're precluded. If they are clearly precluded, you know, then you're left with other, you know, I guess I would ask, why are they precluded? They may be more advantageous than others or more problematic than others. But if they're truly precluded, then, you know, you're left with whatever's left. I don't know if that's a simple enough answer, but... Dredging a ship channel, I've dredged ship channels deeper than the regular, you know, kind of navigation depth to do the dredging, and then you've got to deal with a host of other issues with navigation in the channel and managing those aspects, so there's some disadvantages to it. Capping can be a problem in a ship channel because you don't want to leave something behind that has to be dredged in the future, so typically you end up having to remove material to place the cap in order to make room for the cap. So,
what is the best way to measure MNA? Sediment cores? Sediment traps?
I don't know that maybe the best way. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I think the first obvious answer is to sample over time and see if concentrations of your contaminant of concern are decreasing. And I think Paul Schroeder and others have said that you need to have a minimum sediment accretion volume per year in order for M&A to be effective. So you do want an area where you're having annual deposition is significant, like over 2 centimeters a year. Now, Paul, you may have something else to add to that.
No, but those are all in the guidance, you know, some of those technology assessment guidelines, the deposition rate, all of those factors.
Right.
But, you know, you can use sediment cores, sediment traps. Those are tools that can be used to help quantify what type of deposition you see.
We have a question that came in. Are most of the on-site decisions made by qualitative visual observations?
I would answer that as no. I mean, visual is important. For example, the sediment profile imaging was really helpful, but I tend to rely on hard data, empirical data that can be gathered and put into a spreadsheet. So certainly nature and extent and different depths and the abundance and quality of macroinvertebrates, that type of thing. Almost all the fish data that you collect and pore water data you collect is empirical.
How do hurricanes and other severe events impact these decisions?
Well, I think one of them is the when you look at sediment stability, how stable is the sediment? And typically you're looking at that on a long-term basis, but also under extreme events like hurricanes, floods, others. Secondarily, also affects how you design the remedies. So, you know, as an example, if you're designing or thinking about deciding on a cap even, as well as designing, is what are those forces that are going to act on the cap and the material underneath. And so you would typically look at certain extreme events, hurricanes, floods, and the like.
Thank you. We are out of questions for now, so we'll wrap up this question and answer session. Throughout the second half, everyone is welcome to send in questions. If you do leave before we wrap up, I want to point out the related URLs, that last item, the feedback form. We really do use your feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback on today's training class. The feedback form is also your opportunity to create a certificate of participation. So if you want a certificate for attending today's class, be sure to fill out that feedback form. Check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. Once you check that box and submit, the system's going to generate a certificate for you. If you forget to check the box, you can go back, check the box, and submit again. We'll now continue on with the second half of the training class, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Tamara Sorrell at Brown and Caldwell. Tamara?
Hi, thank you. So we're going to pick it up here. You can see here the training outline, which is just shown again, so you can see where we are. We've talked a lot about the different technologies, how we look at them, how we look at our site in the context of the available technologies. Now we're going to move on to some of, you know, other fun stuff, which is how do we take this information and develop it into some kind of actual remedial action set of alternatives for our site or for subsites within our site, and then how we evaluate those so that we can move on and actually make a decision about what our risk management is going to be. And I use the term risk management because it is not always a cleanup. You know, we heard earlier about macrophytic vegetation and so forth. Sometimes we don't clean up. Sometimes it's a monitored natural attenuation. So here's our little graphic again, so you can kind of see where we are. You know, we've looked at these technologies. Now we're going to assemble them in a way, and we can do this for either part of the site or all of it or in different manners. And, you know, this is an overview. This can get really complicated. There's a lot of details that, you know, this guidance is not able to really get into. So when, even if you look at something, say, like, you know, dredging or removal, there's a lot of, you know, ancillary decisions to be made that may weigh into your cost. You know, what do you do with your residual water? What is your disposal? What is your permitting? These are all things that we really haven't gone into in detail here that are going to have to be considered in this next phase before you can make a decision about what's appropriate and cost effective here. So we had this sort of little theoretical site that we talked about earlier. We had three remedial zones. One, which kind of all can be looked at together, the other one, which had a variety of conditions related to discharge and habitat and contaminant, and then a third one, which also had a variety of characteristics, but those are more related to physical conditions. And, you know, we're going to, you know, use an example, remedial zone three, just for illustrative purposes. So here we are with our little zones. And in this case, we can see that if you have a lot of debris, it kind of makes sense. You know, it's dredging is going to be a problem for you. Sorry, there's a beeping on my phone there. And I should point out also that in terms of one of the things that, you know, we don't really deal with in this section is public sentiment, the public meeting, the criteria that we all have to address on the community and acceptance. And a lot of times, you know, the public views cleanup as removal. Clean it up, dig it up, take it away, put it someplace else. And, you know, that's not always the best solution. It can be very expensive and it can be very impractical. So this guidance, as you've probably noticed, tries to go through these different choices by looking from the least to the most invasive and disruptive. And it's not that we don't want to do the right thing. It's that we want to hit the right balance between, you know, how intensive a remedy may be and the destruction and cost associated with that and what is really necessary to protect human health and the environment, and as we'll see later in a couple slides, what is practical and effective relative to the time frame. So that digression aside, we look at these different subzones. You know, one is a bulkhead area, you can't do much there in terms of removal. The other is a softer area, maybe we can cap that, but we may have good habitat there where we don't want to do something hugely invasive. And then you have a third area where, you know, capping might actually be pretty favorable. And again, you know, as was mentioned earlier, in situ is really up and coming. And I would encourage everyone who manages a sediment site to, you know, become familiar with some of the technologies and the updates that are out there, because there really are some advances, and despite all the delivery issues associated with in situ treatment, there have been some successes. Okay, so here's kind of a little breakdown in a tabular format. We're not going to do dry excavation because there's really no way to dewater it, and everything else for now is retained. So this is a really basic screening. It doesn't help us a whole lot because we're being conservative here and we're really only ruling out things that are completely unfeasible. So this is kind of hard to read, but, you know, here's our different colors again that we've used throughout this program, where, you know, you're looking at green as something that we think is worth additional valuation and could work for us. Yellow, maybe not. And then the orange is something that probably in the next phase of our assembly of alternatives we're going to screen out because it's really not practical. And it just is another way of kind of looking at the technology evaluation so that you can zero in on how you're going to actually assemble your remedy. So in general, there are different criteria we use when we kind of look at these alternatives. You know, we've talked about what our basic technologies are, and, you know, basically the in-situ notwithstanding, you're kind of stuck with three overall types of approaches. You can remove it, you can cover it, you can keep an eye on it. So the MNR, EMNR is, you know, gaining favor is something where, you know, perhaps there's less destruction associated with it. So, you know, think broadly about what might work. You know, there's a lot of, I've had a lot of agency letters over the years saying, you know, you need to proceed to removal. And I'm like, whoa, you know, we're not at that point yet. We need to proceed to an evaluation of long-term what is going to be appropriate here. So keep an open mind. And then again, remedial action alternatives, also known as correction action alternatives. I'm going to give a quick plug here for what the ASTM task force is doing, and I'm part of that. We are developing standards for sediment corrective action, and those are either in the process of coming up for balloting or will be shortly. There's a lot of really great content in there, and I've been active in kind of trying to define what is a remedial action or a corrective action objective, and that's generally something pretty broad. So as an aside, you know, I would encourage you to become familiar with what ASTM is doing, and when those standards finally do hit the street, they're going to be a nice complement to some of the more detailed technology work that we've done here as part of this tech reg. So moving on with our little site example here, you know, we can't dredge in the bulkhead. MNR is not going to meet our objectives for zone three, and we're stuck with, you know, a limited number of potential alternatives that may work for us. So this gets a little redundant here, but what we're doing is kind of drilling down through here to say, okay, what do we have left now that we've screened out stuff that we think doesn't apply? And, you know, you're looking, for example, at the bulkhead area, you really can't remove it, so, you know, all you could really do is treat it or try to cover it, and similarly in the soft sediment. And then in the depositional area, maybe you can treat it or cover it, or, you know, maybe you do enhanced monitored natural attenuation. Here's where all your modeling and all your additional long-term and short-term evaluations would come in to determine whether, in fact, that is going to work. And, you know, it's always nice if you can do something like that and not have a whole lot of destruction in your habitat. So here's our little graphic again. Now that we've kind of honed in on, you know, what is our assembly of alternatives, now we're going to figure out how to evaluate them. And I'm assuming most people on this call are generally familiar with the CERCLA 9 criteria that we would use in a feasibility study. And basically, you have two threshold criteria, you know, which are protecting, you know, overall protectiveness, protecting human health and the environment, and then, you know, you're meeting your standards. So, and then you go on to your other sort of balancing criteria, which is that first bullet, the effectiveness, implementability, and cost. And then you have, you know, as I mentioned earlier, your community concerns, and, you know, we've added sustainability here. That really hasn't been a formal criterion. It's certainly a growing concern, and sustainability, as many of you may know, is the triumvirate of, you know, environmental, social, and economic. So in a sense, all of these criteria touch on that, whether it's cost or community concern or, you know, the how intensive energy or carbon intensive the remedies. Those are all things that, you know, we would like to see included. There's some movement towards that. A lot of agencies, including EPA, are still a little hesitant. They want a greener remedy, but they want to green the remedy during the implementation. And I think here what we're saying is we need to consider those impacts as part of our selection and remedial development process so that, you know, we pick something that's appropriate. I just want to touch really briefly, as I mentioned, REO. You know, what is an REO? There are, you know, various ways of looking at it. It's generally more of a qualitative or semi-quantitative way of looking at it. You're reducing risk, you're managing migration, you're preventing ebullition, something like that. It's not necessarily a quantitative cleanup goal. You know, a remedial goal is really the number that you put on your particular contaminant or a volume or something like that. And they're a little bit different. So, you know, I like to actually think about the REOs right in the beginning of the whole investigation process and before we even get into the technology so that everybody's in agreement about what we're trying to achieve. It's neither practical nor necessary to clean up every waterway to a pristine condition. We have a large number of very impacted urbanized sites that really are never going to be restored completely. And so, you know, what is an appropriate REO? And that we're assuming in this guidance that has somewhat been established up front, but keep it in mind and in the spirit of what we call adaptive management, which is the fancy term du jour for just, you know, being flexible as you move through a process. You know, you may need to tinker with that. And once you're happy with it, keep referring back to it, so that everything makes sense and that, you know, you don't get down a rabbit hole somewhere. So, you know, you got to reduce your risk, and then you really want to select to implement a remedy in a way that you are being as little destructive as possible and that you are achieving your goals in the long term, which may or may not be feasible. I've got a couple slides later on that. So I like these, this and the next slide, because they're very illustrative. This looks at, for a real site, and this is from Todd Bridges from Army Corps, great sediment thinker. And this looks at how a bunch of different alternatives would reduce theoretically fish tissue concentration and how much they would cost. And I would encourage everyone to do something like this because you really want to lay it out visually. And also if you go to a public meeting or you're meeting with stakeholders, you know, a lot of this complexity is beyond what most people really, you know, are able to understand. And this is kind of a good way to look at it. And, you know, fish tissue concentration is a very important endpoint for a lot of sediment sites, both for human health and ecological health reasons. And I would say it's probably the major driver in almost all of the sediment megasites. And certainly where we're dealing with the, you know, what Steve talked about, the PBTs, the bioaccumulators, PCBs, pesticides, dioxins, and so forth. So if you were to look at this, what would you pick? Think about it for a second. How much money would you spend to get how low? What makes sense? So, I mean, I think most people, I'm guessing, would probably pick 3 or somewhere between 1 and 3. Once you get into 4, 5, and 6, you're spending a lot more money, not getting a whole lot more benefit. So just one way to look at it. But there's another variable here that's not considered, which is the time that it will take for your cleanup goal, your tissue concentration to be realized in the system, to be achieved, versus what would happen under no action. So this is another slide that I really like, which kind of looks at that issue that way. Here's our six alternatives. Now we want to hit some low goal, and you know this is a little bit different because we're looking here at concentration and not fish, but it's kind of the same idea. If you look at all these over the decades, and now we start to think about the price, bearing in mind that alternative one was the least expensive, gives you kind of a different perspective. It's just something to think about. You know, as the years go on, maybe it doesn't make a whole lot of difference what you did, except for six, which was hugely, $60 million or something. You know, maybe that's appropriate, maybe not. I'm not here to make judgments about how society should spend its environmental dollars. I'm just using this as an example to show that in the long term, you're not getting a whole lot of different bang for your buck out of distinguishing between, you know, one through five. So if you're not going to go with six, you might as well go with one and save money. So again, all of this is complicated. There's a lot of modeling. But it's interesting, I was at the Battelle Sediment Conference, when was that, last January, and I sat in on I chaired a session, actually, one of the speakers from an agency, and was talking about a sediment megasite and showing how, you know, all of these concentrations were going to go down over all this time, and it showed something very similar to this. And somebody from another agency stood up at the end of the talk and said, you know, based on this slide, why are you bothering? Why don't you just leave it alone? It was kind of a tense moment, a little bit entertaining. But, you know, it really brings up a lot of important issues that may be beyond the scope of this tech reg, but are important in dealing with your stakeholders, you know, and certainly dealing with responsible parties who are going to be footing the bill for all of this. So moving on, I think we've kind of talked about this a little bit, but, you know, it is important to balance cost. And right at the beginning, Steve talked a little bit about controlling sources, and that's just really important. I want to emphasize that, not only for M&R, which is the aspect here, but overall, there's a lot of desire to move ahead with things and get things cleaned up and get it done. But if you have ongoing sources, not only will they mess up your, you know, attainment of whatever cleanup goals you have, they, you know, you're not going to be able really to implement anything and see if it's effective. So, you know, M&R is basically letting it recover if what is being brought in that's going to basically armor your sediments is equally contaminated material, then it's, you're not going to be able to demonstrate any kind of compliance with your remedy. And then we've talked a little bit about adaptive management, which is just, you know, seeing how things go as you move along. And I know, for example, with the Hudson River, there's been a lot of evaluation every 5 years. Everybody goes back and looks what's working, what's not working, so that, you know, do we need to tinker with it? Do we need to change it? And again, costs. Cost is important. No matter who's paying, it's, you know, it's money out of our society. And, you know, is it being just the best way to spend it for any given site? Here's another way to look at it that's kind of fun. You know, I'd encourage you to use these kinds of tools if you really have to make or communicate important decisions. Here's a bunch of theoretical alternatives, and then the benefits by criterion. So again, you can see, well, you know, what would you pick here? You know, and it depends, you know, what is your concern? Is your concern cost? Is it, you know, protectiveness? Protectiveness is pretty much the same for all of these. So you know, what are the big differentials here is, you know, the long term. So, and, you know, also the, you know, long term and permanence, which to me are very similar. I mean, you've got a good remedy, but, you know, is it sustainable in the sense that, you know, in 30 years, is it going to be there? Is another superstorm going to come in and, you know, blow your cap away? Those are all, you know. And, you know, we haven't addressed climate change at all in this tech reg, but again, something to consider in this growing agency pushback on some of the M&R and containment remedies because of concerns about massive disruption, especially in coastal areas. This is kind of a boring slide, but again, it's just following on with these different criteria. And I would refer to the green and sustainable remediation just because it's a topic that's near and dear to me, and I do think it has growing resonance. And I would also say that, you know, most communities, even though they may want you to dig it up and take away, you know, the public is pretty adept, and, you know, people understand these issues. It's worth trying to communicate them and, you know, to come up with a it's all about balance. This whole section is really about, you know, we've got the technologies that are going to work, but, you know, what are we really going to pick? And there are a lot of considerations that are not really technical, but that are also social and political. So circling back to our little hypothetical example, this is kind of where all of these discussions and evaluations ended up. So we're really actually not going to do any removal. Notice. I didn't assemble this, but I think this was done deliberately to show that, to highlight some of these other technologies that can be effective. So I don't know, Juliana, whether we take questions now.
No, we'll go ahead on with the next section, and
okay.
I'll turn it
so
over
then,
to
you. So then, you know, I'm going to pass the baton here on to Rick Beach of GVA, and he's going to talk after he's done all this about the very important issue of how we monitor. Thank you.
Thank you, Tamara. Can you hear me okay, Juliana?
Yes.
Okay, great. I'll switch right over to the first slide. Right off the bat, I'm going to tell the audience a little secret here, that if you download the slides, you can look at all the speaker notes. So with that proviso, then that means I don't have to follow all my own notes. So please make sure you pay attention to those. But I will talk about the topic, and the topic is really an important issue here, monitoring. It seems like the base of most of our informed decisions and approaches that we use on a site is really monitoring, but really it's considered under the veil of characterization when you go to learn about your site. And why it's important here is that, remember, this whole thing is about remedial selection. And in remedial selection, monitoring will vary depending on the remedial approach and method that you select. So you have to go through this whole process for any remedial action that you're considering. And I have to say here that the ITRC planning approach and all the input from the team that put this together did base a lot of the inputs on the EPA data quality objectives process, but also incorporates other EPA remedial guidance, Navy guidance, and other references out there that was used to develop material, as well as the experience of a lot of the trainers. So this is some of the first kind of bullets to help people understand the kind of components that are going to be in here. And why it's important, for example, on construction, people measure turbidity associated with the resuspension during remedial or during remedy implementation. But the real reason why that's important is that the turbidity is a surrogate for the suspended solids, and most of the sediment contamination are on the solids. So in essence, what the turbidity is a surrogate for contamination that may be remobilized during a remedy implementation. So it's critical. It's also monitoring is important while, in other words, to understand if the remedy was both implemented and finally constructed, to reach those post-remedy goals that you needed to achieve a certain amount of risk reduction. And lastly is to evaluate the effectiveness in terms of overall influence of those changes in the sediment conditions and remedial approaches to what the end receptors really were, and in this case, the example was the fish tissues. Monitoring timeline. There's different elements for monitoring that take place pre-remedy, during the implementation, and post-remedy. One of the things I'll point out here is that you see where characterization and monitoring are both pre-remedy, but they're very different here. In the characterization, most sediment sites have their data assembled over easily 20 years of investigations, evaluations, toxicity studies, you name it. And so once you use that to evaluate your risk and even feasibility options, and you go forward to start to make your plans going forward, you really do need, in many cases, sort of a clean the slate baseline monitoring. Recent project that I've had, which is a series of tidal basins that were connected, had a high suspended load. I think I mentioned this in one of the comments to one of the questions and answers, that the suspended load was so high that the concentrations, particularly in the upper 6 inches, could vary quite significantly over the last 10 to 20 years. What was decided in that case with regulatory approval is that we basically wipe the slate clean and reestablish what that baseline was. And in doing so, we actually had to tweak the remedial footprint to capture the current conditions on those things. So it's very important to both understand the role of characterization as well as the baseline monitoring. In the remediation implementation phase, as I said before, the TSS is a good surrogate for the particles and contamination from that. But there are other things too, particularly if you have particularly water quality criteria that have to be met that's not necessarily due to the suspended load. Those are other kinds of monitoring measures that will be incorporated or should be incorporated into your construction monitoring. In the post-remedial phases, you do your performance monitoring for different things. They can be done to show that you're reaching your sediment cleanup levels, or they can be physical monitoring, where that if you're putting in a cap, not only is your cap either isolating the original contaminant in the sediment or providing a barrier to the residual contamination following removal activities. But it could be as simple as just making sure that the cap is still there with the right thickness to provide that physical isolation, or like in the note here, that that it could be related to the overall average sediment contaminant concentrations. And that could be influenced by the cap in addition to any incoming sediment with low levels of ongoing contaminants or just background contaminants. So both the physical and chemical monitoring might be elements in a post-remedy monitoring. The other part of the post-remedy that's shown here is the effectiveness. Again, are you meeting your overall risk reductions as measured by fish tissue or any other risk recovery types of metrics in here? So monitoring are all important elements of all of those. Let's see if I missed anything. We'll go through a six-step planning process. This is really interesting and useful in order to follow these, whether you do it formally or informally. The people that had great input into these slides were really strong and firm believers of following this as a regimented formal process. I believe that the process can be used regardless of the size of the project. Too often we encounter projects, maybe you're 20-foot wide or even 10-foot wide ditch, where you don't want to go through the thought process and formalization of of writing down all the objectives and describing how you're meeting each one of those. But I think the discussion is really important in itself in order to understand these varying elements. And that's what I think the value of the six-step process is have the discussion. If you have the money, the budget, and it's an important enough site with a large enough risk on it, then make it a formalized process in order to set you up for the most successful project that you can have. In the first step, state those simple questions, you know, things that are mom and apple pie for us. What are the objectives we need to do in the different phases for the baseline, the construction, the post-remediation? Make sure you understand really what you're trying to answer. Then determine the measures and the methods and the approaches that is going to be needed to answer those questions. And they can be chemistry, physical, biological characteristics. And don't consider yourself limited in terms of what you consider for those metrics and the surrogates for those metrics. We'll talk a little bit more about those in some of the later slides as examples. Steps three and four, you have the categorized as boundaries, but really you're talking about the sampling units. And by this, the way I characterize this is that most sites are not a single unit. If you consider any kind of sediment site, even your ditch, particularly any long ditches, there's going to be different elements, characteristics, geomorphological conditions, flows, deposition, that are going to occur in different areas. Separate out the things and isolate those, don't isolate them, but separate the things that make sense that you would categorize them with similar chemistry, similar physical characteristics, similar biology, similar risk. And then go through the monitoring discussion and steps with that in mind for each one of those. You may end up combining them back together, but have that discussion when you're looking at the boundaries in the different zones or operation units so that you can define the best monitoring approach for each one of those. Step number four, then document again how every measurement you're going to take. It's not just because you want to do it, it's a continuation of what was done in the characterization of the baseline, but have those defined and specifically focused on answering each one of your questions. Too often we end up carrying forward measurements that are no longer needed. Conversely, sometimes we go forwards with things in the characterization that should be extended much beyond what we considered when we first characterized that in terms of, particularly in terms of overall end use of a site. So consider those in the context that your questions were raised and the measurements that you need to get to those answers. Something that's in the notes that's not in the slide itself, I think Dan had put in a really important issue here is that in certain measurements, like methylmercury, there's a temporal component in your measurements. So that if you're measuring methylmercury, for example, it's a biologically mediated contaminant. And in the summertime, when the biology kicks in and the temperatures rise, and anoxia sets in some borderline conditions, your methylation processes increase drastically, and you'll find easily an order of magnitude increase in your concentrations in the summertime than you may in the winter. So remember, for certain kinds of contaminants, there's a seasonal component that's not related to things moving around, but just due to how they're created. So remember that is a really good important feature that I think Dan Michael, I believe, was the one that had that comment in the notes there. Very good point. The last two elements, data confidence and design, probably the most understated thing when people are working in sediments the first time. Underwater, people view sediments as being all the same and more or less uniform, sort of like I envisioned when I was going through some of my graduate work, is that the oceanic abyssal plain where everything looks the same and concentrations must be the same. And what you learn in the sediment community when you go out and do your investigations is that the uncertainty is grossly un, underestimated in almost all projects. And as you start doing more and more projects, you'll get a certain feeling for where that uncertainty is, what the magnitude of the uncertainty is, how to evaluate the uncertainty, and that's a primer toward if you don't understand what the uncertainty is, how can you possibly understand and have confidence of what your final result's going to be after that when you've applied some remedy? So understanding uncertainty is the first element and is an important element you should consider as you're going through your steps in your monitoring program. And then design your monitoring program. Look at the areas, look at the questions, look at the answers, look at the approaches, and then put together the monitoring program that you need to represent the areas and the information that you are trying to have at your disposal to make sure that you can say that you have had a satisfactory program. I don't know if I'm going fast or slow, but we'll continue going. Slide 71 is a great matrix table here of an example of monitoring measures. Again, it's broken down almost in the categories of the pre, during, and post-remediation process of baseline monitoring, construction, et cetera. And the monitoring objectives are slightly different in each one. And then they show both chemical, physical, and biological examples of categories of those types of measurements. Probably the most important thing that I would say from this is that this is not a list of everything that you should or need to do. I would like to consider this to be more of a menu. Pick and choose the right things that you need to do. This is not a complete menu, but it is a really good diverse menu of the types of things that you can do in the different categories of measurements at the different phases. And what you see after a while looking at some of these, they're very similar. You're doing many of the similar kinds of chemical measurements, physical measurements, and biological measurements, slightly different for different phases, but really they're changed because they're answering different questions at each of the phases of the monitoring and each phase of the project that you're applying the monitoring for. So keep those in mind that it's a menu. They are intended to answer different questions. Whether it be in construction monitoring that the right cap thickness is put down, the right amount of sediment removal is removed, that you're removing sediment contaminated to a certain depth, or is it to a certain concentration that you're trying to make sure that you remove, or that you're installing a cap of a certain thickness, that overall that the cap thickness is the right distance, right thickness, or the removal volumes and thicknesses are adequate to meet your remedial design criteria. Poll question. Let's turn on the first polling for this. Have you ever been involved in assessing performance based on fish tissue analysis? And my favorite over the last couple of years have been methylmercury. So has it involved methylmercury? I'll answer my own, so I'll throw in my own vote and see how this is coming in. It's interesting. I'll make a comment on this. We'll give it another 15 seconds or so. There's been a lot of, probably a 3-to-1 ratio on people who have done fish tissue analysis as part of their projects that they've done, and involved with mercury, 2-to-1 have never been involved in, it's changing a little bit, but 2-to-1, let me see, so 1/3 of the people have never used, evaluated mercury in the fish tissue analysis. Mercury is a ubiquitous contaminant, much like PCBs of previous decades. Mercury is one of the big contaminants du jour, or de decade, I guess as it should be. And methylmercury is the most toxic form of mercury that we find in the environment. The what's important and drives many sediment remediation projects in many areas right now. What I will say, and most sediment practitioners know, is that the majority of the mercury that you will determine if you do a total mercury analysis in fish tissue is methylmercury. Saya Chin and others have, there's an enormous amount of literature documentation on this, is that I think the if you run a total mercury analysis and do the fractionation or a separate analysis for methylmercury fraction, methylmercury usually makes up between 65 and 100% of the total mercury found in fish tissue. On average, I think by my numbers that I was getting is around 85% of the methylmercury or the mercury in fish is methylmercury. So it's really important. So if you don't have methylmercury analyzed, make the assumption that the majority of it or all of it is methylmercury and use it in dietary models or however you're evaluating your risk and your calculation of remedial goals that you may want to have based on mercury. You can close the poll now. Thank you, Jayana. Claim that. I have been talking relatively quickly. Now we have actual data. I'm not sure if too many of our previous slides actually showed data. I'm happy to show data. This is a confidential project, at least it was when we generated this. You can see that the data stops at around in the 2012 time frame that season. Maybe 2013 if it's between the axes. And what I'll show you here, let me turn on my little arrow, is that the right axis, vertical axis, is the mercury in red in the sediment concentrations. And before the cap was constructed in approximately 2011, sediment concentrations were in the range of maybe 50 to, well, there are quite a few outliers there, but the medians ranged in the 200 micrograms per kilogram, in the 100, let's say up to 100 milligrams per kilogram in the sediment, with some outliers going up to 400 milligrams per kilogram. The fish tissue concentrations that were related in the range, the same areas, existing in the same areas where the sediment contamination was, had mercury in the fish tissue concentration ranging from, let's say, 500 to maybe 1,400 micrograms per kilogram. After the cap was constructed, the idea is that you are creating a barrier. I'm not sure in this case, it was not my project, whether there was removal prior to the cap. But the in the surface concentrations, which this was the sediment concentrations were collected from, probably the top 6 inches, the concentrations in the top six dropped to very low. I'm guessing this is in the 10 milligrams or lower milligrams per kilogram. The interesting thing is that the next time they sampled the fish concentrations were still high. This is relatively typical to see, you know, obviously if you remove the mercury and put in a cap constructed of sand with a background concentration of below 1 milligram per kilogram, then even if you get some secondary recontamination of that cap, you're going to have a very low surface sediment concentration of mercury. The fish, though, have not grown up and incorporated or not incorporated the lower concentrations yet. What typically happens, and good bioaccumulation models will reflect this, was that they'll actually can even have a bump in concentrations in fish with nonpolars and sometimes mercury compounds, where the fish concentrations actually don't go down but go up the year or two after remediation. And I would predict that the concentrations are probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 to 150 milligrams per kilogram in current years would be, I'm not doing a good job, on the left axis, of the 400 to 500 micrograms per kilogram mercury would be there or even lower. I've got to talk to the individual whose project this is and see if we can get some updated data. Conversely, if there are any good sediment practitioners out there that have a good data set that shows these two trends in both the pre-remediation, post-remediation monitoring, that's really valuable information. So I'll leave that open to both the audience in general. And I believe that's it for my technical slides. So as part of the training, we've now gone through the introduction, the remediation, and now the remediation selection and evaluation, and now through the monitoring. And I believe Sarah is going to take it back over and hopefully wrap this thing up with us with stakeholder concerns and summary. Sarah?
Yeah, listen, thank you, Rick. Great job. You're right. We've made it to the home stretch, and Chapter 8 takes us into the stakeholder concerns. As some of you may or may not know, the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, commonly see that acronym of NPDES, is one of many examples of how science behind watershed management works to achieve goals and principles that form the basis for the public trust doctrine model for protection and management of our water resources. Multiple impacts from contamination sediments in a regional watershed, especially bioaccumulative compounds, contribute to regional fish consumption advisories, as we saw back in that map that we showed at the beginning of the, I think it was slide 9. Sediment resources are managed and protected for the benefit of the public and the environment. And we know risk reduction alone may not be capable and cannot always achieve the important goals of the Clean Water Act, which is to return the resource to a fishable, swimmable conditions, even navigable. Responsible parties, state, federal cleanup agencies, even local government, wildlife, fisheries, watershed managers, and local stakeholders. They're examples of who should be brought in to the remedial decision discussions. A long-term view of the resource locally and regionally needs to be part of the decision-making process. Evaluating all these sites from a regional or larger watershed management viewpoint should be a part of the decision process because the cumulative impact of multiple sites in a watershed can seriously impair the regional aquatic ecosystem as well as human health, especially going back with respect to the bioaccumulative and endocrine disruptor compounds. Groundwater, as we know, or we may not know, some of us, provides a significant contribution. Let's just take the Great Lakes system in Michigan. In Lake Michigan alone, 78% has been reported of the water in the lake has its origin as base flow from the tributaries. What does that mean? It means that 78% of the water in Lake Michigan had to pass through sediment prior to becoming surface water. For further discussion on that, though, I really need to ask you to please read the stakeholder section in Chapter 8, where this is discussed more thoroughly. These same interactions drive regional coastal ecosystems where sediments interface with brackish and salt water, tidal ebb and flow. These processes move and redistribute bioaccumulative contaminants as well. Let's say a properly functioning hyporic zone maintains watershed health and regional water quality while providing the aquatic habitat for a healthy and sustainable ecosystem. The restoration and preservation of this zone of interaction is of great importance. It's a significant, if not major, component of watershed health, providing productive, stable aquatic ecosystems. Restoring the sediment, restoration of both aquatic and terrestrial habitat are important aspects of all sediment remedies from the stakeholder perspective. It's extremely important to consider the health of your watershed as part of a remedial strategy. If you're interested in learning more about that, we invite you to look at the groundwater and surface water. This was a single resource by the USGS that was printed back in 1998. The habitat generated by the interaction of salt water, brackish water, and fresh water in the rivers and estuaries of just the Gulf and the East and Pacific coasts, and frankly, coastlines around the world, are essential for species that reside in these communities. Regional watersheds, Great Lakes, and other fish advisories, coastal ecosystems, Chesapeake Bay, important fisheries, and economic issues, these economic issues cannot be ignored. The international audience that we've had the honor of addressing in this training event today is a sign that this is a global waterway issue. For all of us communicating, becoming engaged with tribes and all stakeholders early in the remedial process will help to develop a shared resource-driven discussion. It forms a cooperative basis for remedy selection and implementation. This ITRC training event has been held to something like 2 hours. We've only scratched the surface, though, of what's included in our web-based guidance document today. Please, we invite you. No, I want to urge you to go on to the online document to learn more about the remedy selection framework. Worksheets to download and assist you in the compilation and comparison of site-specific data and information, monitoring considerations of Chapter 7, and the stakeholders' view from Chapter 8. Yep, lost my place. Sorry about that. So advantages to this guidance. Remember, the ever so important point and click will take you anywhere in the guidance document that you need to go or that you're interested in. Now we believe, we hope, that you are better prepared to identify, evaluate, and apply the knowledge that you've learned today. Explicitly state actions for the audience. We look for you to use the ITRC technical and regulatory guidance document. With that, I'd like to thank each of you for attending today's training event. And before I turn the microphone back over to Juliana, I would like to personally ask each of you to take a moment to provide us with your feedback, knowing that your comments can help us to be better at what we do. Thank you again very much. And back to you, Juliana.
Thanks, Sarah. I'm going to echo that request for feedback. And Sarah's a great person to ask that because she's involved in one of the new courses we're developing. So the feedback that you're providing is going to help us not only improve this course, but other courses. The feedback form is also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today. So if you would like a certificate, be sure to complete the feedback form and watch at the bottom, check that box to certify you attended, and that's going to allow the system to generate a certificate for you. Right now, the only way to get that is by the feedback form. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, fill out the form again, check the box at the bottom, and that's going to get you your certificate. We do have some questions that have come in, and also I have a final poll question for our audience as well. So one of the questions that came in, has there been a trend moving toward DNA barcoding to improve granularity of benthic macroinvertebrate assessments, or are there older standard sampling techniques still the standard that we use today?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Steve Clough. I think that DNA barcoding techniques are really great techniques for addressing diversity. I'm not sure how well they do as far as abundance. And I have not seen this used anywhere in the environmental world yet, at least in the consulting world. Although I do think it's a huge tool and will evolve quickly and might be able to lower the cost at least maybe 10 to 12 years from now. But I would just think the cost of DNA barcoding in and of itself would be prohibitive. But to answer the question, I have not seen it done, and that the standard sampling techniques are still the gold standard, I think.
It seems that the choice of bioaccumulation models can alter the choices and the cost for this approach. Is there a current consensus on the most appropriate modeling methods?
This is Steve again, and there are lots of bioaccumulation models out there. It's actually mind-boggling when you get into just bioaccumulation and biomagnification alone. I would tend to lean toward what the regulators want in the state or the region, EPA region you're in. That's what I would do. because choosing your own model and then trying to convince the regulators that it's the best may be self-defeating. So that's probably the and I would add that being having a good relationship with the regulators, a lot of face-to-face time and back and forth would help you gain trust, which is important in the cleanup and remedial process.
One of the slides referred to a reasonable time frame for the remedy to be judged successful. How long is a reasonable time frame for remedial actions to achieve RAOs at a mega sediment site?
This is Steve again. From a fish tissue point of view, I would think you're looking at, well, they probably sample fish every 3 years, roughly. So I would think that you really can't get a good trend going until, you know, 9 to 12 years. But, you know, the other instructors can chime in, but I think that most sites would be deemed successful if you've looked at a span of 10 to 20 years, is my guess.
At the minimum, if not longer.
Yeah, I would say decades, Steve. You know, measuring it in decades.
Another question came in, how do I go back and watch the first 30 minutes of the presentation? And this is Juliana. We will provide an archive of the training class, and everyone who registered will get an email once the archive is available. If you don't want to wait, we have an archive of a past offering of this same class. And tomorrow, if you come back to the same website, there'll be a link for you to get to the archive. If you want it immediately, go back to that Clue-In training page where you started today, select the Clue-In Sun in the upper left-hand corner, and then you can use that bar at the top to navigate over to Training and Archives. And if you just do a word search, you can find an archive of this same training class. So if you have any problems finding the archive, let me know, and I can give you a link up to the archive of today's training class. We have a comment that came in. This is an excellent presentation. I bet much of it review for the multi-year professional in the industry. Another question that came in, and this came in during tomorrow's section with the predictions made by the remedial action alternative evaluation models. Do you have any good examples of how the predictions made by these models compare to actual cost, mass reduction, time frame, et cetera?
That's a pretty big question. I mean,
is that Leo's question?
More specifically?
I gave a response to that online, I think, if it went through properly.
It did. Can you tell us a summary, maybe?
Yeah, so I thought a couple of, you know, good examples might be the Sangamo West and Lake Hartwell PCB site, where they had an M&R remedy in 1994. So, you know, now you've got several decades of monitoring record to look at, and they look at things on a five-year review basis and have continued to hold with the M&R. While it may not perfectly match what they had expected, the trends do continue. So I would encourage you maybe to take a look at that. Another site Yeah, so I was going to say the other site was the Hudson, where a lot of data went into the calibration of the models, and the dredging was just recently completed, so if you're looking for a post-dredging track record versus what was predicted, it's pretty limited. You've only got a couple of years of post-dredging data out there, and that's undergoing a five-year review as we speak. But, you know, those are extremely complex model on the Hudson perspective. The other thing I would say is on actual cost versus predicted cost, it's just a personal item. I've done tried to do that research in the past and have continued to try to collect actual cost data, which is quite challenging at these sites. But there is a database of information on predicted anticipated project outcomes and actual outcomes, both from a kind of remedial effectiveness standpoint, but also costs on it's called the MCSS database that's available on, it's referenced in the guidance document, but it's available on the Sediment Management Work Group's website. And for probably about 100 sites, there's information available going into the project and then, kind of actual experience.
Thank you. We are out of time for today.